Hello, and welcome to True Romance. This is Devin Leary, and I'm joined by my sometimes friend, sometimes enemy,
Carolina Barlow. That is me, and I'm here to stay.
You're like, hello world, this is me, life should be, ooh, ooh, yeah, fun for everyone.
This is me. Powerful sentence. Devin, how are you doing this week? What have you been up to?
Okay, well, I've been moving, which is really stressful, and job searching, which is also stressful.
Both sound fun.
So my respite for these times has become rewatching The Office. Now, let me preface this by saying I am one of the only Americans alive who has not rewatched The Office before. I watched it when it first came out. And I didn't even finish it. I watched like the first three seasons when it first came out, and then I never watched it again. So like the problem that I've had in life is that people will say like, have you seen The Office? Have you seen 30 Rock? I say yes. And then they quote something and I say, I don't know what you're talking about because it was so long ago. I don't remember any of the quotes. Whereas people who are super fans can like recall every single word or whatever. So I've decided to take advantage of that and to finally rewatch The Office to get through this stressful pre-herd immunity time. We only got a couple months left. I just want to like laugh and get through. And so I've been rewatching The Office, and the thing that's shocking to me is how much it is simply just a show about relationships. Like, it's just love stories. It's Jim and Pam, as we all know. It's Angela and Dwight. It's Ryan and
Mindy Kaling, one for the books.
Kelly. And Jan and Michael, Carol and Michael, Dwight and Michael, and Jim and Rashida Jones. Oh, Karen, I think her name is. Jim and Karen.
One of the best love triangles because you really sympathize with Karen the whole time.
Okay, so this is what is so hard. I am so invested. I literally will scream at the screen. I go like from Pam is toxic, Pam is toxic, Pam is toxic to Jim, what? Why? Like, what are you doing? No. To hating Karen and just that she's there. Karen did nothing wrong, but I just like hate that she's there because I'm like, why are you standing in the way? To
I can't believe you're this invested because the rest of the country has been at herd, we're all at herd immunity for being affected by The Office.
I know. I just like when I watched it in high school when it came out, like I wasn't that invested because I didn't really have reference, I guess. I don't know. I just was like, okay, like Jim and Pam are want to be together, like whatever. But this time around, I have so much more life experience. I'm so much more affected by it. And one thing that I didn't expect to have such a strong reaction to is that Angela and Dwight, I think, are a perfect couple. I think they're what all of us should aspire to because they both are completely in love with the other person for exactly how they are. Like, they are two kind of strange people who don't get along with most people, and yet they have, like, they love everything about each other, they embrace everything about each other, and they show up for each other in these weird ways that, like, any normal person would be like, why would I hold a microphone for you while you sing Little Drummer Boy?
That's a running joke. It's so funny that that's her favorite song. What I love about what I think is the brilliance of that relationship on that show is that they think they need to keep their relationship top secret. That they value that above everything is the secrecy of their relationship.
I also noticed that, unfortunately, maybe for myself, I do relate strongly to Jan because she's clearly like so much better than Michael in so many ways. And like, he's so problematic and like, just no. But at the same time, she can't help herself in a weak moment from accepting the validation of like, well, I know this guy will, basically she's like, I know this guy will pay attention to me. And like in a weak moment, sure. Like she's going through a divorce. She's like, sure.
She also finds him, though, sexually irresistible.
Yes. And, well, it's funny because it seems like so far she finds him sexually irresistible in the moments where he does something normal. Like, it seems like she gets so frustrated with him. She gets so annoyed by him. And then he'll do one thing normal. Like the first time they kiss is because he like sells a deal to this, to what's his name from SNL, Tim Meadows character.
One of my favorite
episodes. Okay, well, anyway. Yeah, he's like, well, so like you should just like sell your paper to us because we're the best place, whatever. And she's like turned on by it. Then the second time they kiss is because he told everyone in her office that they hooked up. And she got almost like charged with sexual harassment and fired. And then he apologized and said that he made it up. He's like, I just like was making a joke and someone took it out of context. I'm really sorry. And he acts like a normal person. And then she kisses him. Like she's like, she wants him to be normal. And she's like, I'm attracted to him physically and I want him to be normal. And like, I can't stay away. And so the episode of Casino Night, which is historic for so many reasons. And yes, I was screaming at my TV. And yes, I sobbed.
The first episode I watched of The Office was Casino Night. And I cried and I didn't even know the characters. But I think the scene between Jim and Pam, when Pam says, your friendship means so much to me. And Jim says, no, don't do that. I want more than that. And then she says, I'm sorry if you misunderstood things. And he's like, I'm sorry if I misunderstood our friendship. That is gaslighting on her behalf.
She's toxic. Toxic.
But yes, the Jan Levinson at Casino Night is understandable.
So Michael, like, why am I recounting episodes of The Office? But basically, Michael invites two dates to Casino Night by accident because he invites his realtor Carol, who genuinely is interested in him, and then he invites Jan thinking Jan would never come. And in a moment of weakness, Jan goes and he's like on a date with someone else. She's pissed, but there's this moment where she gets in her car. She just said, I drove 2.5 hours to get here, and she gets in her car and she has a duffel bag like she had prepared. She was gonna hook up with him and spend the night, and now she has to drive back. And I was relate so strongly to this. She's like smoking a cig, and I was like, Jan, listen, it's hard for us career ladies like myself, who is on ZipRecruiter every morning sending in my cover letters, and Jan, who is running a multi-million-dollar paper company. It's hard for us sometimes to find real love, and she might find it in Michael. But anyway, I just have loved watching these relationships unfold.
There was a period in my wild days where I would always keep a fresh pair of underwear and a toothbrush in my party purse because I didn't want to go. I wanted to do the walk of shame right. I wanted to be able to change into something the next day, and I wanted to brush my teeth. And the only bad part of that plan was going home after not going home with anyone and being like, didn't get any action tonight. And I'm humiliated by the thought that I did by this fucking purse filled with a goodie bag of next morning essentials.
That's like when you clean your whole apartment because you think a guy might be coming over, and then you get home at the end of the night to your clean apartment that's for no one besides yourself. And it's
just like, you feel like a clown at Wrigley's Circus.
Eat an entire pint of ice cream. But also, have you ever been on a date with someone who presumes they are staying over, like they bring a duffel bag?
I've been in situations where I can tell the person assumes that we are going to hook up, and it's very uncomfortable.
It's not right.
It's just more awkward than anything. The people that this has happened with are, for the most part, have been nice, and it's just me being like, okay, so I'm going to slither out of this. I think that Steve Carell is so hot. And I don't mean like unconventionally or whatever. The scenes where he's hooking up with someone, he's just so himself. And obviously he's married to the actress who plays Carol in real life. And I think their relationship is so hot. And I remember reading an article with them. I remember reading an interview with him where someone asked the secret to marriage, to long-term marriage. And he said, great sex. Having great sex all the time. And I was like, so you are so hot. And I just love it. And then they asked her at the Oscars when he was nominated for Foxcatcher. An interviewer asked her, how are you feeling tonight, to his wife? And she had tears in her eyes. And she said, I'm just feeling very proud. And I was like, I'm going to just put that on my vision board.
What did Nicole Kidman say on the night when she mouth kissed Alexander Skarsgård instead of her husband when she won an Emmy?
That's on your vision board?
That's on my vision board of like iconic moments, I guess, but it was so disturbing. Like Toby Keith her husband? No, Keith Urban. Keith Urban is standing there with a perfectly good French fry highlights from 2003
yes.
and perfectly good acid wash True Religion jeans from 2007.
Tribal tattoos from 1998. Tribal tattoos,
perfectly good. Again, perfectly good, perfectly good, perfectly good. And she just like kisses him on the cheek. And then on her way up, she's like, oh, Alexander Skarsgård, how about a full makeout? How about that? But I don't know. That's just, I don't know. I'm no expert. What the fuck am I even talking about?
So back to the office on the subject of gaslighting.
Yes.
Karen, who is who Jim ends up with, is being completely gaslit by Jim because Jim's obviously yes. still in love with Pam.
Jim is toxic.
And Pam.
Jim is toxic.
And Pam, both of them. They're flirting in front of her. We've all been a Karen in a situation where you want to just be like,
yes,
go be together. You guys obviously are in love.
Right.
Don't put me through this.
Yes. We have all been Karen. That's a good point because I immediately distanced myself from her because I saw her as a boundary to Jim and Pam. And I was like, okay, I am not her. And I know she just wants to be doing Hot Girls Wanted, like important documentaries. So why is she even here? But I totally agree. You're right. We have all been her. And it's fucked up. Like, I thought it was fucked up that Pam tried to be like friends with her. She's like, I feel bad that I was mean to Karen, so I'm going to try to be her friend. Don't try to be her friend. Stay away from their relationship. Now they're in a relationship because you fucked things up, because you said no because you wanted to be with Roy, fucking Roy, who tucks his shirt into his pants with a belt instead of Jim. So that's your problem, and stop like inserting yourself into Karen's life.
I love the episode where Pam gives Jim advice that basically gets him to be closer to Karen. Jim and Karen are in a fight, and Pam basically tells Jim not to blow it. And then later she's sobbing because she can't basically believe that she misses this guy so much and that she helped his relationship at all. And
oh my God, I didn't see this one yet.
I'm so sorry for spoiling it, but
no, go ahead.
Dwight pats her on the back while she's crying, and it's this beautiful moment. And he takes off his jacket as if to give it to her and then just ties it around his waist. And then
he is such a genius.
Pats her on the back and goes, you must be PMSing pretty bad right now, huh?
No.
Anyway, we can take that out. But I agree. It's all about relationships and about timing and how messed up timing is. Wait, can I?
I know.
Speaking of timing, can I say a crazy thing that has happened in my life recently?
Yes.
Okay. So
there's this guy at work.
There's this guy at work.
He comes to my desk every day.
We're best friends. No, okay. This is kind of wild. And I feel confident about talking about it because I don't think either of them listen to this podcast. So in high school, I was in love with this guy. We'll call him Reginald. I mean, I thought he was so funny. I thought he was so smart, brilliant, sexy. He was talented. He was a singer and a songwriter. And we would have these amazing days. And it was a gaslighting on his part. He would spend days with me where he would play me piano. He would take me to meet his extended family and go swimming with me. He would...
Wait, aunts and uncles?
Yes.
What?
Yeah, all of it. And we would have so much fun together, but I was just in love with him. And I was it goes back to me just not being able to not do something or say something that I think of, that I would say to him, like, I love you. I want to be with you. And one of the worst events, question mark, of my life, that's pretty brutal given things I've gone through. One of the more unfortunate times in my love life, we were together in his room, and we were just standing there, and it was pretty obvious that we were going to hook up. And I said, come over here. This is me being so open on the pod. God, we're just standing in his room.
Ooh, and you're so vulnerable. I love it.
He was leaning against a wall, and he said, no, you come over here. And I walked over to him, and he turned the lights off, and we sat facing each other on his guest bed, and he like sighed. And he was like, we're never going to be together. And I was like, okay. And I said, can you turn the lights on? And he turned the lights on. And he was like, I love you as a best friend. And I'm like shaking at this point because I'm like, I'm like cold. I'm like, wait, what just happened? And our friends come over to meet up with us. And at this point, I'm like, how do I get out of this situation? Like, I need to get out of the situation without running out of the situation, which is something I've faced before in my life when like something awkward comes up with like someone I have a crush on where I'm like, I want to leave. I don't know how to leave without being hysterical, which
right.
Now in retrospect, as I'm older, I'm like, just leave, like be hysterical. Who gives a shit? Just get out of there and like go cry at home or whatever. So I'm just like, I'm so upset. Our friends come over, which we had planned for because we're at his house and that's where we all hung out. And I can tell that he realizes that like something's happened that like that's unchangeable, which is that like he's basically drawn a line in the sand. I feel terrible because of it. And so he keeps on saying these weird things like, you look really hot in front of all of his friends. And I finally look at him that night and I said, I hate you so much. And then as I'm leaving, because we had always joked again, like the part of the gaslighting was we were always joking about getting married. Like, oh, we're gonna get married and have kids one day. And
fucker.
He looked
fucker,
at me
motherfucker.
As I was about to get in my car and he was like, you will be like an incredible mother someday. And I was
What's going on?
So I just
wait, how old were you?
17 or 18.
Okay, what? Yeah. Ew, I hate men. I hate teen boys thinking they know fucking shit about anything. Fuck that.
So I just went home and sobbed. I just couldn't believe it because this was like one of my best friends too. Like this was someone who I thought was so hysterical, so special. Anyway, and so this was like when I was 17 or 18. It took me years before I met someone that I felt this way about again. And since it was like kind of my first love in a lot of ways, like this, it just really affected me. And he was sort of the person, not, I don't want to say who got away, but there was something romantic about him to me always. And he was like the king of intrigue. And we even lived together with a bunch of friends at a certain point in Brooklyn. And I remember I was sleeping in a bunk bed. And I remember one night he was dating someone and he sat on my bunk bed and like stared at me and talked to me while I was in bed. And I was like, what's going on? Like, I was just so confused. I was like,
toxic.
But at the same time, I was old enough by that point to think like, oh, you need this attention from me. You don't want to be with me, but
a narcissist.
Yeah. So, but I was old. I'm like laughing because it's so crazy. I am friends to him up to the point of he came to my birthday party a couple of years ago and I was dating someone. And I even was open about, I mean, which I in retrospect shouldn't have been, to the person I was dating about how like, oh my God, I used to be in love with this guy. Because I thought like, it's so obvious that I'm not anymore and I'm in love with you. And the way I felt about my ex was so much more than I felt about this guy I was in love with in high school. Anyway. I'm definitely at the point now in my life where this has been literally 12 years ago when I had this interaction with this guy. So I'm not anymore like, oh my God, will we or won't we at all? And it's very clear to me what happened, which was that someone loved the attention from me, but didn't want to romantically be with me. But they didn't also want to spend time with me. They didn't know how to reconcile all that. But I saw him on Instagram. And I did a double take and it was a picture of him and one of my best friends from high school with their arms over each other in Hawaii. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Like they're dating?
Yes, they're dating in Hawaii. And let's call this girl Jane. So Reginald and Jane are fully dating in Hawaii. And he posted
I'm
something
fully
that's
dating in Hawaii. Only in Hawaii. Once they go to regular US.
Why does it have to be paradise? Can't they be in like Akron, Ohio? And they're like swimming in the ocean together. And he posted something that like having so much fun in Hawaii, getting to spend a lot of time with Jane. And I live with my sister and my mom. And so out loud, I was like, oh, my God. Reginald and like Jane Smith are together in Hawaii. And even my family was like, what? Are you serious? Because you do have this thought like, well, that was in high school. That's over now. Like, move on. And then you're like, wait, they're together in Hawaii? What the fuck? I'm not attracted to this person anymore. I feel like the need to say that. But it's just the ego of it all that I'm like, are you kidding me? And so right. because I'm shameless and just truly don't care, me and this girl haven't talked in years as well. I follow her on Instagram because she's private and I want to see her posts. She lets me follow her but does not follow me back. So I'm like, this is a cruel, calculated, cold move. No, I'm just kidding. But I was like, how it is. She's posting pictures with him. I'm just like, oh, come on.
Okay, can I say one thing though?
Yeah.
Or can I say actually a half an hour's worth of things, since this is a joint podcast and you are forced to listen to me talk? To me, that sounds like they're both so stunted. High school relationship. He was clearly like the king of the campus in high school. He was not really popular at all,
but he was so funny and so weird. He would wear short shorts to school for no reason except that it was funny, which obviously I thought was like the coolest thing ever.
Okay, but he hasn't progressed past high school. You just said that when you lived with him, he was still doing the same shit of like gaslighting and like hitting on you in an inappropriate way when he was in a relationship, when you had fully progressed past that and he had not, and now he's back with a girl from high school.
Hitting on me. He was flirtatious.
So that's inappropriate. It sounds like he's stunted and he hasn't grown at all as a person. He's still leading people on. Even when he's in relationships with other people, he's having emotional things with other girls. So no, he's just stunted. I feel bad for this girl. It doesn't matter that they're in paradise. Paradise means nothing when your mind is stuck in high school and you'll never grow past that because you're an attractive man who doesn't have to try. Okay?
I mean, I'm grateful that you are saying all of this. I more think of it in terms of, I went through a breakup a year ago. Your mind sort of naturally drifts back to the past after a breakup, at least in my experience.
Totally does, yeah. You're like, wait, who was meant to be with me in college? Okay, there's like six candidates. What are they up to? They're married. That's fucking hopeless for me.
And so I wasn't even thinking about him because literally he's very physically attractive. I'm not attracted to him anymore, mainly because I think I'm just tired of thinking about people after I've thought about them for a really long time. But it's more of the fact of like, it reminds me of High Fidelity where John Cusack is calling all of his ex-girlfriends and he calls his first girlfriend who cheats on him with some guy in school. And he's calling her to see what went wrong in all their relationships. And she's married to the guy that she cheated on him with in school. And his mom her mom picks up the phone. She's like, Clarissa actually married her first boyfriend. And he was like, I was her first boyfriend.
But oh my God, I haven't seen that movie. Should I watch it?
It's one of my favorites. It's okay. Such a meditation on relationships. Okay. So besides that, I have been family members turn off the pod, masturbating to romantic scenes in movies because porn has been freaking me out and makes me sad. And so I've just been doing that.
What are your go-tos?
They're so weird.
Okay.
I like romantic kiss scenes. I'm going to say that. And you might think they're really hot. But they're pretty vanilla. So. Okay. When Harry Met Sally. You've okay. Got Mail.
Okay. Shop Girl.
Shop Girl. Oh, I didn't even think about that.
The You've Got Mail one is just so like, it's just, there's a lot of like intense music and. So I might find that distracting. The dog would be maybe distracting, but I'm glad you can get past that.
I think that there's something about me that's just really turned on by romance. As ridiculous as that sounds, it makes me sound like a joke in a movie that like a girl masturbates to like a Nora Ephron movie. But that's just where I am at emotionally. We have an amazing quarantine segment to get to.
Yes, we have another edition of our hit series, Quarantween, the brainchild of Jesse Konevsky, and we're going to just let her get right to it.
Hey guys, Jesse here with your True Romance Quarantween Report. I have a little story I want to tell you guys about a young man named Sav Bhandari. Sav Bhandari was attending Lakehurst High School in Canada when his school suddenly burned down and he had to attend the rival high school nearby. Even though he was thrown into a new situation, he thrived. He ran for class president, joined the coolest rock band in school, and found love multiple times despite his parents wanting him to pursue an arranged marriage at age 17. In fact, Sav found love in so many different places in high school that on the night of his senior prom, when somebody entered the prom with a gun and shot a fellow student, Sav didn't realize because he was busy making out with his teacher in a nearby classroom. Obviously, Sav attended graduation, and he's a proud alumni of the Degrassi Community High School class of 2011. And just like Anya, Holly J, Miss O, and that possible wife, I too loved Sav Bhandari for many years. So when he finally left Degrassi, I accepted the fact that this was a fictional character and just followed the actor who played him, who is Raymond Oblock. And I'm excited to say he's on a new show that I want to talk about today called Ginny and Georgia. Is Ginny and Georgia a tween show? Maybe not. There's definitely a lot of adult sex, drinking, drugs, murder, scandal. It really doesn't fit my G-rated kiss me on the cheek in front of my locker and give me butterflies mold, but there's a lot of Degrassi alumni and there are a lot of 15-year-olds, so we're going to let it slide. Ginny and Georgia's main focus is about a toxic relationship between a mother and daughter, but my main focus is obviously on the teenagers in the show. Ginny is 15 years old, she's new in town, she's never had friends before, and yet fits right in. Before she knows it, she's going to house parties, being serenaded in the hall with a tap dancing birthday tribute, writing slam poetry instead of your standard AP English class essay. She is living the life. She's definitely struggling with depression and dark thoughts, and all this together makes me want to root for her, but it's tough to root for her. She right away goes for the dud guy. He's clearly toxic. He's got toxic written all over him. She's got this great boyfriend who is cool and respectful and loves going down on her. He's smart and he's just like a great guy. And of course, she's lusting after the dud. That is an eye roll right in itself. Then she's definitely a follower of her friends. If her friends steal, she steals. If her friends drink, she drinks. If her friends lie, she lies. If her friend slaps her, she apologizes. All of this is typical of a 15-year-old, but it makes it hard to root for her because you're sitting there at 40 years old and you're watching her and you're going, do not make these mistakes. I've been through it. It is not worth it. The writers on this show have a hard job of writing for teenagers, but all of their conversations just kind of miss the mark for me. There's a lot of talks happening about race and relationships that feel very surface, and I know they should feel much deeper than they are. I won't even mention Taylor Swift's opinion on some of the jokes in this show. So the characters aren't super likable, the writing is a little clunky, and there's a lot of far-fetched storylines going on. But you know what? For a new show, it's super addicting, it's easy to plow through, and I'm watching Sav Bhandari light up my TV screen again. He plays Joe, he's the best character by far, he's grown a beard which looks really hot, and I love that he's on a show with other Degrassians. 5 out of 5 stars. Now, I did briefly mention a serenade, and I have to tell you, I love a serenade. If you're wondering if I've ever been serenaded, I would answer, of course I have. I am a boy band fangirl. If you're a boy band stan and you have not been serenaded, you are doing it wrong. I'm not at the level of some of my friends. Shout out to my friend Jody, who was brought on stage for a Backstreet Boy concert. But, like, I have some serenades in my history. Let me tell you my favorite one. If you know O-Town's origin story, you know that they were selected from thousands of guys, then narrowed down to 12, narrowed down to 8, narrowed down to 5. When they got to 8, the 3 that were cut formed their own boy band called Element, obviously spelled L-M-N-T. That's who serenaded me. Look, I've been serenaded by O-Town too, that's another story, it's great. But Element, they like held my hand, they sang to me, they put the mic in front of my face to let me sing. It was a moment. Where did it happen? Okay, so I found out that Ben Stein was hosting a quiz show in Times Square at the GMA Studios and that Element would perform in between takes. I know, it makes no sense. I went. The audience was filled with like people that read the encyclopedia and me. They start playing Hey Juliet, which if you don't know from Radio Disney in the early aughts, I would say give it a listen, but you know what? Don't. I knew all the words. They saw someone who knew who they were. They saw someone singing their songs. They loved it. It was a great moment between all of us. Ben Stein made some stupid comment about how, like, well, they might be pop stars, but everybody else here is a genius. And I was like, F off, Ben Stein. Anyway, that was my serenade. And not that we are counting or anything, but it happened 6 years before our Ginny character would have been born and about 30 years before she would have been serenaded in the hallway by the guy that she ends up cheating on because she goes for the dead. Anyway, check out Ginny and Georgia on Netflix. Get addicted. Get serenaded. That's my take. I'm out. Thanks.
That was our quarantine segment with Jesse Konefsky. I have never met someone, and I've never met Jesse except via the internet and your birthday party, but I've never met someone who was in the crowd at TRL.
I mean, not only in the crowd, but also many times physically on TRL, such as the time that she showed me a video of where it's her. It's like Carson's like, okay, we got a like an audience request, and it's like cut to Jesse as a teenager going, "Hi, this is Jesse from Brooklyn. I want to request a Limp Bizkit," and then I forget the name of the song, but she's like, "Wow, thank you, Carson. Hi, Carson."
Love it,
and
so
it's so good. But she said that she wanted to request like some boy band song, but they told her she had to request a Limp Bizkit, which is really lame.
Carson Daly fucking sucks.
I know. One of my other favorite stories about her is that she, I think outside of TRL, asked, is it Scott Foley from Felicity?
Yes.
She, outside of TRL, handed Scott Foley a printed photo of her with Scott Foley outside of TRL a different time. Like, she had the photo printed of her and him the first time she met him. And she brought it with her and gave it to him again and said, "Can you sign this?" And he looked at it and said, "That's weird." And then signed it. So
I
good.
I love her so much. I also just love anyone who says, "Oh, I know them from the O-Town days," which is something she can say.
She's just an icon in every way. And we are going to take a quick break, but then we're going to talk about another icon, and that is Demi Lovato. We'll be right back.
I want true romance.
And we're back with True Romance. I have to preface our subject today, which is the singer and I want to highlight songwriter and actress, performer, Demi Lovato. She, last night, we made a plan to talk about her YouTube series, Dancing with the Devil. And Devin, I've been so distracted by so many things. So last night, before we recorded today, I thought I have to watch every episode so far of Demi's Dancing with the Devil documentary. My mom was watching Angels in America, which I was kind of getting sucked into.
Classic.
And yeah. Meryl Streep, dressed as a rabbi. Incredible. Emma Thompson, this amazing nurse. I mean, just talk about relationships. Woo! So I was getting sucked into that. But it was getting to like 8 p.m. and I was like, I have to watch the Demi series. And I was like, I can't believe I'm getting walking away from like a award-winning play slash miniseries to go watch Dancing with the Devil YouTube. Oh, this is sucks. Sit in bed, play episode one. Episode one, I was like tripping over the keyboard to episode two. Again, trip thing like, thank God there's an episode three. So angry that I couldn't watch the episode four yet because I'm not like a YouTube Red subscriber. But today we're going to talk about the first three episodes. We understand that our journalistic integrity is being compromised by the fact that we haven't seen episode four, but we will watch and do a mini episode on that, I believe. And in the meantime, you have two love addicts here who are going to talk about Dancing with the Devil and give our thoughts. Obviously, we are going to mention, trigger warning, some stuff on assaults, hospitalizations, drug use, etc.
Yeah, I had a different experience than you, it sounds like, which is that I actually was tuned into YouTube at 2:50 Eastern time on Tuesday, the day the first episode of Dancing with the Devil premiered, which was set to premiere at 3 p.m. Eastern time on YouTube. I watched the premiere special concert featuring Demi singing and then doing a sit-down interview with the director And I literally counted down the seconds and minutes until the premiere aired. So that was my kind of thing that I did. The performance that she gave.
She's an incredible performer.
Yeah, she did a performance for the premiere that was at like the Beverly Hilton, I think. And she performed Anyone, the iconic Anyone, her like, you know.
Her ballad.
Song. Her ballad about like the darkest time in her life. And it was so beautiful. I obviously cried. And I also love her new look. She has this new like really short haircut. And she's been wearing like oversized shirts. And she had like just she just looked amazing. And I loved it. She sounded amazing. And then I got into the first episode. And so the last docuseries she put out was like it was dark and it was about her addiction and stuff, but it was like mostly hopeful. There was like some, you know, Wilmer Valderrama stuff. It was like kind of light and fun, and I was not even at all prepared for how dark this Dancing with the Devil immediately got.
I wasn't either, and I think it's because you and I we're weirdly inclined to watch dark things or interested in dark things or interested in personal dramas. And
yeah,
I assumed that she would be talking about her overdose, and I assumed it would be a linear classic story of, gosh, I came close to dying. I'm okay now. I'm a champion. I am fine. I had no idea how close she came to dying, and I had no idea how hard her recovery was. I had no idea that she almost went blind. I had no idea she had mm-hmm. been assaulted by her drug dealer mm-hmm. and that she had then reached out to him after the fact because she wanted to hook up with him again and basically erase the memory of trauma by doing so. I thought it was incredibly honest of her. I think what was interesting about the documentary and is that it? She is not someone who seems totally fine now.
Right. I mean, I think just first of all, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Demetria, for your honesty. And she did not have to be that honest. She did not have to be that vulnerable. And it was really powerful that she did do that.
And she obviously has a lot of expensive therapy language that many people don't have access to. So I completely agree. I do think it's a service. I have never thought about trauma in those terms before, where you, if you feel traumatized by a man, you might be more inclined to reach out to him again because you want to rewrite the narrative. I've never heard of that. And it was fascinating and made complete sense to me. So I do think she's doing a service by being this honest.
She definitely is, and I think she's just, like, such a, you know, speaking of Jesse Konevsky from Quarantine, something that Jesse said was, it's just so sad that this is someone who, like, probably just should never have been in the limelight. Like, she didn't really choose to be. She was a child actress. I'm sorry, but I don't trust her mom. I know her mom is interviewed in the documentary, and she's talking about how she's like, you know, you can never control your kids and you have no idea what they're doing outside the house. It's like, well, you knew what she was doing when you put her on Barney when she was like 5. Why did you do that?
You put her in beauty pageants.
Yeah, I just feel like she was forced into the limelight. She was forced into this, you know, and I've thought about this before. Like, I am someone who's struggled with, you know, eating disorders, body image issues, and extreme insecurity. I don't think I'm cut out for, as much as they're knocking down my doors, I really don't think I'm cut out for being a celebrity.
And that's
I
know why they you keep calling. With
Barney
RCA.
Called me too. Yeah, no, so Barney called me too, and Scott Scooter Braun called me too. And I said, listen, I would love to, but I just am not cut out for the limelight. No, but I am like, I could never like have my photos blasted everywhere. I would never recover from that. I would never recover from just someone taking my photo without my permission, because it happened to me all the time in middle school where people would tag you on Facebook and you had to like remove the tag, and I literally would be traumatized. I'd be like, oh my God, this picture is so ugly. My nose is so big. Everyone can see my braces. Like, I will not get over this. And this is Demi's life every day since she was, you know, however old she was. And so I just think it's sad that she kind of has been forced into this life where she's completely controlled and completely attacked by the media at all times, can't do the right thing, can't do the wrong thing without everybody knowing about it. And it kind of made me sad that, like, it seemed like a lot of her friends were, like, employees.
Matthew Scott Montgomery and Syrah.
Yeah, I was like, I don't trust Syrah. People who are friends with their, quote, sober coach.
No.
Maybe, like, look a little deeper. I don't know if I would trust that. Like, this person is paid to keep you so... I don't know. Also, Syrah just had this energy of, like...
The worst.
She was my girl. And so, like, yeah. I was like, bitch, you better not do that. And I was like, Syrah... You're like from the Midwest.
She talks
just
about
blue hair.
Syrah
doesn't mean that you're edgy.
Could be 45 years old. We just won't know her age because of some work she's gotten done. We won't know Syrah's age. She could be 100. She could be 5. And
she could be named Sarah and she's 50 from Minnesota, but she has rebranded as Syrah with blue hair and a Delia's graphic t-shirt tied around her boobs.
She does
so
have the affected vibe, though, of like punk rock, whatever. She's like, I caught... You know, Demi, like, smoking heroin or crack. And I was like, bro, this ain't it. And I was like, okay.
I know.
Can we talk in a different way, please?
Can we just be normal about it? Can we be normal about your best friend smoking crack? It's normal. Just act normal.
I think that Matthew Scott Montgomery had very strong Jonathan. How do you pronounce Jonathan?
Chebin. Unfortunately, Carolina, the pronunciation is Chebin, which is actually the worst possible way that that name could be pronounced.
He has very strong food god Jonathan Chebin vibes of someone who, again, might be 40, but is still very much the Steve Buscemi meme from 30 Rock of like, what's up, my fellow youths?
I know. But she has her sisters. I was glad she has sisters who seem like they love her.
She has sisters, but it just broke my heart how isolated she is, no matter what.
Yes.
And the saddest part to me was the night before her overdose when her friend is talking about how she's like, no, stay the night, please.
Yes.
And her friend was like, while I was driving away, she was waving out the window. And... It made me so sad to think, oh, whether she knew this intuitively or not, it seems like subconsciously she was like, please don't leave me alone with myself.
Yes.
And I had no idea the her family history, not just that her mom, you know, looks like a classic stage mom and that, but I had no idea her dad was so ill. Her dad had terrible alcoholism and was abusive and it sounds like was bipolar and schizophrenic and that he died alone. I had no idea those facts about him. And that's just so unbelievably tragic and also hints, obviously, because all of that stuff is genetic, at how extreme her issues may be and obviously where they can take her. Speaking of sober coach and Syrah, the most fascinating part or the part that had me thinking the most about the documentary was that she had been forced sober before, that her sobriety had never been her choice necessarily, and that there was this manic control around her. And I knew about her somewhat through other people in the entertainment industry, and I'd heard that she had been on a show where her handlers had reached out before, being like, there can be no snacks around Demi. And that's crazy.
The reason that I became such a big fan of hers was because I saw her Stay Strong docuseries on MTV when I was like newly getting sober and like getting out of a rock bottom in my own life. And I had never like heard someone openly talk about an eating disorder before. Like I just literally had never heard someone talk about that. I was like, oh my God, like this is me. I relate so much to this. But she released this new album with the documentary called, I think it's called Dancing with the Devil also, but I'm not positive.
Yes, The Art of Staying Over. The Dancing with the Devil, The Art of Starting Over.
There's a song on the album called Melon Cake. And it's basically like, I am not going to eat melon cake for my
birthday
anymore.
Yeah.
And I love that because it's like, I relate to that so much where you're like, even like, I remember, it's so depressing to think about. Like, even like, I was thinking about watching The Office and they go to Chili's all the time. Like, the first time I went to Chili's because I was anorexic, I ordered the tortilla soup, which obviously is disgusting and the worst thing you can get at Chili's. Like, you're supposed to get like onion rings. And I was like eating this like watery soup because I was like, this is all I can have. And so the fact that she like wrote a song about how hard it is to have a birthday when you won't allow yourself to like indulge is so good. But yeah, it was fascinating to hear about how she like had to, she talks about in that song too about like firing people for like eating chocolate around her. And I know that that sounds like a monster, but that's what you become when you have an eating disorder, is like you become a monster, basically.
Well, it's this idea that I can be healthy if I have all, quote unquote, negative, all triggering impulses around me. Like, I can get sober if I go somewhere where alcohol is legal. You know, something, this idea of control rather than choice, which I think was very prevalent in the documentary about how her assistant, who is the only person in her friend group who I really sympathize with.
Oh my God. She seems so traumatized.
Yeah. Her assistant said, like, I'd have to spend the night if she ate a cookie, basically to prevent her from binging. And I can only speak to myself when I say, listen, I do have to throw some food out in the house that might trigger me. And then this is like, I've been in remission from an eating disorder for like 10 almost 10 years. So for instance, if I get like a bar of like Hershey's chocolate, I sometimes have to throw that out just because I'm like, I know myself well enough, I'll eat the whole thing. But I definitely don't need to, like, you can eat what you want in front of me and I'll be okay. And if I did eat the chocolate, I wouldn't throw it up. This is all to say that if she's having people get drug tested around her to make sure no one smokes pot who's near her, it's not that she's making a choice to stay sober anymore. That choice is being made for her. So she doesn't know. Of course, she doesn't know why she's sober.
Yeah. And to me, it's like, I really believe that the only, this is just my personal belief, and I'm not an expert at all. So please do not take it like as again, like Hollywood's knocking down my door. People are knocking down my door that thinking I'm an expert. I'm not an expert. I'm not a celebrity.
You turned down Scooter Braun.
I turned down Scooter. I turned down being an expert. And so it's fine. But I think that the only thing that truly matters is wanting help and wanting to change. So like, it doesn't matter how much money you throw at the problem, like how many people you force to be around you, how many people you pay to like remove triggers and do like,
and how many people love you.
Yeah. Or how many people love you. If you don't want to be sober or if you don't want to be healthy, you won't be. You just won't. Like, it just doesn't matter. And it seemed like she did have so many things in place to like protect from this one moment of weakness happening, and it was just bound to happen. But I will say, like, I felt so bad for her assistant. And as Carolina knows, during this pandemic, I have said before that I think assistants are essential workers and should get vaccinated as essential workers, because assistants go through so much, including this woman who had to literally discover Demi Lovato dead.
Jordan Jackson, yeah. Her assistant, who was absolutely completely traumatized by, I kept on thinking about her too in terms of how she didn't know if she should go in the room or not. And if she had waited longer, Demi would have died, and how much guilt that would have had on her conscience. I always think about the worst case scenario because that's just what PTSD has done to my brain. So I kept on thinking about that, about how close she had come to feeling guilt for the rest of her life over just not going into this closed bedroom door of her boss, and how traumatizing that must have been. And, but yeah, this element of control is so fascinating to me. And I at first I was annoyed that they were interviewing her caseworker from a rehab, because to me, all that stuff should remain private. And I would freak out if they're interviewing my therapist on my docuseries. But
I know, especially because he was like, I told her, I said, what do you, and I was like, okay, so you're just like repeating the good advice you gave but okay.
I did think it was really interesting that he, compared to Syra, who was supposed to like, I don't know, give her La Croix and take away her beer or anything, I thought it was really interesting how he said, she told me that she didn't want to be here. And I said, who's paying for you to be here? And she said, I am.
Right.
And he said, then you can leave. And it's that idea that's so scary, because at first, when I was hearing about how terrible her father's death was and how close she came to dying, you know, my instinct and the instinct I've had with friends before is, the good, keep her from any sort of alcohol and drugs. She'll die. It's like, keep the loaded gun away from this person. And then you think, oh, I can't do that forever. No one can do that forever. And if this person doesn't want to be sober, there's no amount of control I can put on them to keep them sober. And then, you know, she did relapse again after her near-death experience, which I also thought was very indicative of how powerful that disease is. And even Scooter Braun was like, wait, I believed her when she said that she was never going to do heroin again. And everyone says, like, I just thought there's no way. And then she did. And that then she came back to her rehab counselor and was like, okay, I need help.
That was when she was ready. Yeah. No, because like, okay, so I loved what her sister said. I forget exactly what the question was.
It was, would you ever want to give up on her?
Yeah. And her, everyone was like, no, like I knew I never wanted to give up on her. And her sister was like, yeah, I definitely at moments was like, okay, if you want to drink yourself to death, drink yourself to death. Go ahead. And I thought that was like such an honest answer, because I think any of us who have loved ones who are struggling with like a baffling addiction where like no matter what you do, they can't break out of the cycle of denial. You do at times feel like, okay, so there's nothing I can do for you. Like, I give up. Go do what you want to do then. And so, yeah, but I do think, yeah, so she like, she legally was dead. She had this horrifying overdose. Like, she almost lost everything. Luckily, she had like the best doctors in the world working on her case who came up with like this insane like blood mechanics to keep her alive and like prevent her from losing all of her vision and stuff. Again, I think that was like not her choosing to get sober. That was like a devastating incident, and she still wasn't willing. So it took like, I think that kind of makes sense that it took something that was within her control to realize she was powerless. Like she on her own was able to see that she needed help aside, like without the whole thing of like being in the hospital and everyone saying you have to get help.
I want true romance.
Unfortunately, that was when one of the villains of our time, Scooter Braun, was brought into the series. And
this documentary series is Scooter propaganda.
It truly is. And of course, like, Ariana Grande has to feature on one of the songs on the album because it's like all his minions. But listen, of course, Scooter is like, I was too busy. I wasn't even going to sign her. I didn't even, but I was worried that she was going to get taken advantage by other people. So I had to step, like, I'm like, could you make it more about yourself and make it more mansplainy? And like, I am going to save this person's life. Like, you're a music manager. You're not going to save her life because you signed her. She can get signed by whoever the fuck she wants. She's Demi Lovato. Like, she had a whole career before she met you. And he's making it seem like he saved her life. And she kind of said that too, but I think that's because she's brainwashed and has Stockholm Syndrome. And I'm sorry that on top of everything else she's dealing with, she has Stockholm Syndrome, and she is dealing with a lot. She has substance abuse disorder. She has depression. She has all this stuff. And now she has Stockholm Syndrome, and I'm sorry that she has that, but hopefully she gets help from it.
Okay. I'm really worried that people are going to come after me for saying this, namely Beth Jacobs. I was kind of like, I understand what Scooter's saying in some of this.
Okay, in what sense?
I like how he was like, she needs a friend and someone who knows what to do. I will say, I do think he has used her recently to refurbish his image. She went on Ellen and she just was like name checking Scooter. Like, she was like, I used to have to eat melon cake, and now I have a new manager, Scooter Braun, and he made sure I had birthday cake. And I was like,
Wait, do we know what the melon cake is, by the way? I just assumed it was like healthy, like low calorie cake.
No, it's a watermelon, babe, with candles in it.
No! What?
Yeah. Which is very much like... It's not even like a sugar-free? India from Nexium.
Yes.
If you go on her Instagram account, which I did, you know.
I do all the time. She's at the top of my algorithm.
Have you scrolled back to when she was in Nexium and seen her birthday cake that's candles and a red pepper?
No, I have not seen but I will be checking that out.
What exists.
Okay, I thought it was like a low calorie, like vegan. Like, when I was anorexic, I used to go to this health food store and get like a vegan sugar-free apricot oat bar. And I would eat it for literally 75 minutes. Like, I would like take the tiniest bites one at a time of this apricot oat bar and be like, okay, that's my indulgence for the month. and I'm grateful for it. So I thought it was that, but a fucking melon?
The craziest part about this is that if anyone knew how much Devin likes to eat now, I don't think you've stepped foot into a health food store in like the past 5 years.
Well, in fact, yesterday I walked 3 miles in 30 degree weather to get ice cream, and I got an affogato sundae with mint cookies as well as a kitty size passion fruit ice cream. And then I walked back across 3 miles and got 2 pizzas, and I don't regret it. But
that's just proving to our listeners that recovery is possible. And once Devin was over at my house and we ordered pizza, that took an hour to get there. And so we sent my mom to go get it.
Also, I remember saying, like, why does this have to happen to us? Why us? Why us? And Carolina kept saying, like, I've actually...
Like, what's her name who gets hit by the pipe for the ice skater?
Oh, Nancy Kerrigan.
We are very much like Nancy Kerrigan. Why? Why?
But Carolina was like, at one point, I think you said, like, I know I've actually been through, like, really bad things. And I was like, I haven't. This is the worst thing I've been through.
No, but I was like, but this is still really bad. We have to talk about the fact that Demi is not sober right now. And to me, that's really sad and really scary. And again, indicative of how hard denial can be, or how you can still believe you have a control over something, that she's like drinking wine sometimes and smoking weed. I mean... I do understand what she says when she's like, recovery is not one size fits all. There's different ways of doing it. I do think there's some people who just have to be like, oh, I can't drink vodka or I'll black out, but I can have beer or whatever. I don't usually judge people when they make decisions like that, because I'm very much like, you have to just figure out what works for you, I guess. And if, you know, you're happy and you're healthy and you feel good about that, then sure, I don't care. But... when someone has literally knocked on death's door and is partially blind because of this decision made previously, which is, and she was like, initially first I was like, I'm just going to drink. And then I was like, oh, I've never tried heroin or crack.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of confusing because there's one song on the album that I forget what it's called. And it's like, talking about how one glass of wine, I'll be fine. Like how she thought maybe I can just like drink a little bit. And we did see footage of her on tour, which I loved that they threw in this footage of her like drinking on tour.
Didn't that remind you so much of when you used to drink?
Yes, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, unfortunately for her, that looked like almost exactly like how I was when I was drinking, which is like, let's do shots. And also the thing with like saying, please don't leave. That was totally my MO when I was drinking. Like, I literally would be like, okay, I will buy whatever anyone wants in terms of drugs if you will stay. Like, please do not leave. No one leave. No one is leaving. Let's agree to it now. Like, I was like, I will do whatever I can to make people stay with me.
I remember you leaving a party once with 2 of our friends and you saying, let's go get tattoos. I'll pay for you guys to get them.
I know. Like, I even after I stopped drinking, I was like, couldn't be alone with my thoughts. So I would like try to force people to stay around me no matter what. And I was like, that reminded me of myself too. And so I can't really imagine someone who drinks like I used to drink being able to drink every once in a while, because that's not my experience. But she has this song on the album where she's like, I had one glass of wine and thought I'd be fine. And then basically like I did heroin and almost died, or like legally died. And then she has another song called California Sober that's like the total opposite of that, where she's like, I can't put labels on it. Like, I can like do whatever I want. And it's like, I don't want to be controlled. I want to be all, it's not black and white. It's all the colors of the rainbow or whatever. And I'm like, well, wait, which is it? Like, I don't understand. Can you do whatever you want, or can you not have a glass of wine? But I don't know. I feel really bad. I think she is still in the throes of darkness. And that makes sense because it hasn't even been that long and recovery is like a slow journey. So
I think that we are used to a specific narrative from TVs and what addiction looks like in TV and movies potentially. And I think like relapse is a part of a lot of people's stories. But this is what's fascinating to me. When I stopped drinking, I thought it was life changing, because that's sort of what my life had revolved around for a long time. Now I don't think it's remarkable that I don't drink.
Right.
I actually don't think it's a huge sacrifice either.
Yeah.
Once in a while, I feel awkward at parties, not because I'm not drinking, but just because I feel like I don't know who to talk to, whatever. Did I just say something weird? Normal social stuff.
I shit my pants. You know, normal social stuff.
I shit my pants. I wish I had a drink to,
can anyone smell that I shit my pants?
I took a shit on the floor, like the girl from...
Flavor of Love. Oh my God. Is that normal? You know, normal social stuff. Am I going to get a clock tonight? Am I going to get to wear a giant clock around my neck?
I tell everyone normal that I look like Beyonce. Someone tells me, no, I look like Luther Vandross.
You know, she's normal, like, Beyonce, social stuff. I spit.
Beyonce, you look like Luther Vandross.
I hock a loogie and spit on someone's face, and the someone's name is Pumpkin. You know, normal social stuff.
So this is all stories from when I was a contestant on Flavor of Love. No, I guess what I'm trying to say is not drinking is not a sacrifice to me anymore. Yeah. I used to think it was like, wow, I am like fucking Mother Teresa. I can't believe the lengths I've gone to stay healthy. It's amazing. When people are like, that's so amazing that you don't drink. That's so cool. Or like whatever. I'm like, no, I mean, it's really whatever. It's like people, would think it's a bigger sacrifice truly not to eat sugar.
Oh my God, that is psychotic.
No, what I'm saying is if I had nearly died, like not drinking would seem like very much a natural response to that. And drinking would seem like Russian roulette. But that is applying logic to a disease that is devoid of that. So there's no judgment on Demi. It's more that I hope she gets well and I hope that she's not suffering. And if this does indeed work for her, which again, it doesn't sound like it will in the long run, unfortunately, all of her fans should understand the nuances of it.
What I loved about this documentary is that she talked about the harmful hero narrative, which is exactly what you're talking about, Carolina, of like, it's amazing that you stopped drinking. Like, you are a hero. You are a health icon. You are like a mental health icon, all this stuff. Like, that is too, that is a harmful narrative because it's like too much for any person to live up to.
Especially when you already have the pressure of like, since you were a kid, providing for your whole family, having assistance and people who rely on your income and your performances and your ability to stay like put together.
Yeah. So I loved that she talked about that and was basically like, I'm just like being the real me now. And I'm not trying to be like some kind of like teen star, mental health icon, whatever. And I think her honesty is what was the most helpful thing. Like you said, I think it will help so many people. And she just was so like raw and beautiful and honest. I felt so bad when she like felt responsible for her friend who got like dragged in the tabloids.
So nuts. I couldn't believe that. Her friend couldn't get jobs. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I thought that it's the same kind of pressure that as a Disney star, she wasn't able to seek help for her sexual assault by, God, I'm dying to know. She was dropping hints on who might have hurt her, and I want to know so I can shame them into perpetuity.
I've been meaning to look it up on, oh no, they didn't, the Live Journal, but I haven't yet.
Whoever it is, I like that you said my Me Too movement was telling someone and them doing nothing about it.
Yeah, because, and that person still getting their like starring role in the movie.
Because it's more about that she was scared to look a certain way by just being victim to something, which is sort of, you know, you're a victim to drug abuse, but people are going to look at you, including me at times, because even drug addiction is so naturally mind-boggling of like, why are you doing that?
Yeah.
Instead of like, okay, so this still has you in its clutches somewhat.
Yeah, no, she was basically like, yeah, she was honest about it, and the one person who could have believed her didn't. So then she was like, why would I go public with this? No one else is going to believe me anyway, which I think is so many women's experiences.
And also, how is this going to look on me? Rather than what's that, how it's going to look on your abuser. It's like, no, I can't tarnish my image by being a victim to this. I'm supposed to be a virgin. I have a promise ring.
Oh my God, the virgin thing. Oh yeah, that God. Was
back in the Joe Bro days.
the clips of Chris Harrison still haunting us and being interviewing Demi in this, I was like, wait, I thought we got away from Chris Harrison and now he's in the
how
Demi documentary.
How much heartbreak can you go through as a 16-year-old? I was like, Chris Harrison, how much
fuck
fucking airtime do you have to have?
I thought you were going to say, how much fucking aerosol spray can you go through spraying your hair to stay in place like a fucking Ken doll psychopath?
I can't believe Chris needs us to speak more about him on this pod.
I know. Chris is like, please. Okay, so every single thing, if Chris shows up in The Office and then I have to stop talking about The Office on the pod, I'll be pissed. But
I want to end talking about Demi's voice.
Wait, I wanted to end on something else, though.
I wonder which one's better.
I wanted to end talking about the song 15 Minutes and
okay, sorry, go ahead.
The next episode is, they're teasing that the next episode is going to be about Max Eric.
So obviously Demi's relationship with Max Eric is a huge interest on True Romance, mainly because we could see that car wreck in slow motion.
And they're teasing, so at the end of episode 3 of Dancing with the Devil, they sort of tease that like the next episode's going to be about this relationship she had that started at the beginning of quarantine, and she told her mom she was bringing a boy home for quarantine. And I was like, okay, the fact that this boy is Max Eric that we saw sobbing on a beach is like, because the mom is like, oh, I kind of was like, oh, I don't know, I guess she's bringing a boy home. And I was like, okay, it actually is the worst possible boy that you can imagine. So just prepare yourself.
The boy that made a Instagram live where he's talking about how he needs to get out of the spotlight and he keeps on pretending to like have a breakdown and cry.
The boy who comments on Selena Gomez's Instagram about how much she loves Jesus and how he's going to marry her because of it.
So the song 15 Minutes that she has on her album is all about like, I hope you got your 15 minutes of fame. It's perfectly put.
There's a lot of great breakup jams on this album. Like, I love that it's like half a recovery album about melon cakes and drinking and then half a breakup album. There's one point in the song 15 Minutes where she kind of like laughs to herself, which gave me some like relief because I felt like, okay, she is like at the point where she's like, I see how ridiculous this was. Fuck this guy. He's on his merry way and I'll never have to deal with him again. And I know, I personally know that he's going to create an Instagram live where he like pretends to cry to it in a bathroom. But that's fine. And so I was just happy for her that she had that empowering moment. But the documentary made me reflect on like, okay, so this relationship was baffling to us at the time because we were like, wait, what the fuck is she doing? Like, is she okay? Is she just responding to the fact that Wilmer is engaged to Sea Monkey and now he has a baby with her? Like, what? But now that I've seen the documentary, I feel like it makes perfect sense. She was in such a vulnerable place, and it's kind of like reminds me of Britney and Kevin Federline, where it's like she just had this breakdown and she wanted security. I think Demi had this horrible thing happen and she probably wanted security. She probably wanted someone around all the time so she didn't have to be alone with herself. And this guy preyed on that, which is sick for him. And that's how she ended up in this like kind of baffling relationship that made no sense and wasn't able to see the red flags because he was like love bombing her.
If you are a singer and you start dating a random and that random starts singing on his Instagram videos, that's a red flag.
Be scared. I know.
He was singing shirtless.
Don't date someone who starts talking about how they want a podcast, because that would be the same thing for you.
I would be like,
he's like,
wow.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like,
are you trying to get my 924 followers?
He's like, I actually always thought of myself as kind of like someone who could do like a dating podcast. Obviously not like your dating podcast, but just like maybe something about like not like true romance, but like honest love.
Gosh, I'm scared already. I just love that there's lines in the 15-minute song about him praying and crying on a beach in Malibu.
I know. And she like repeats the lines too, like, so that it really breaks
in.
Through. Yeah. Also love Easy and My Girlfriends Are My Boyfriend. Is that what it's called?
My boyfriend is my girlfriend's.
Love.
Yeah.
And Melon Cake Love.
She's a very, very, very talented singer and songwriter. And I recommend everyone to YouTube Demi singing Take Me to Church. It is a song that I hated when it was on the radio by Hozier. And I would listen to it all the time if that was the version that was out. She's just an incredibly talented performer.
She is.
And
God bless.
I cannot wait for episode 4. And at the end of the day, Devin and I are both love addicts.
We are, and we always will be. And I wish I still had my Demi Lovato t-shirt that Sean Cullen got for me at a thrift shop, but I don't know where it is. And I hope I'll find it. But at the same time, maybe I don't want it, because that t-shirt is from the Camp Rock days when she wasn't being her true self. I only want a t-shirt from the true Demi that is now. And so,
and she looks hot if anyone right wants now. To send she me looks one, incredible. I'll take it.
She looks amazing. Yeah.
So we are rooting for you, Demi, and
we love you.
We love you. Thank you, True Romance listeners, for tuning in today.
All I ever wanted was a little love. I want true.